Up North News with Pat Kreitlow is a product of Courier Newsroom and has a joint sales agreement with Civic Media. Enjoy.
NorthNewsWI.com.
Tuesday morning in Wisconsin. Pat Kreitlow here with Up North News. And I wanted to pass along a funny tweet about Election Day. And then finally noticed it was my own damn producer who was tweeting it while listening to me yap. Here I was all set to tell him, you should see what I just saw here. It's a picture of Tim Michaels voting. And the caption says, when you remember how to vote in Wisconsin. Then I look up and see Luke is the one that actually has posted it. So a good work out of you, moonlighting as a comedian while you're doing radio producer work.
I was intently listening to your and Michael's conversation
hanging on every word.
And I happened to stumble across that photo, and I thought it was too good not to share.
It is. And I also want to... credit a couple of other my favorite folks on Twitter, George Gillis, with the caption, I didn't know Connecticut had a primary today. And then one of my very favorite accounts, that clerk Rachel, says, okay, I can't tell the depths of this joke because I'm not caffeinated enough, but Connecticut does actually have a primary today. And how interesting would that be if Tim Michaels kind of forgot that he'd already cast a vote in Connecticut before he voted today in Wisconsin. I'm not saying it happened. I'm not even saying it's likely to happen. I am saying it's not impossible for that to have happened. And that's what we have today.
I think it's also important to point out there were like several members of the Trump family back in 2016 when New York had its primary that they either missed the registration deadline or like tried to vote there and another state. And so there is a lot of confusion for people that don't necessarily have a habit of voting to get to the polls and take care of that. And today in Wisconsin, we do have same-day registration. So if you haven't registered to vote, you can go and vote today.
Yes, you can. You just have to make sure you go to the right polling station. Look that up either on your local municipality's website or go to myvote.wi.gov. So Twitter is a very busy and funny place today, not just with Wisconsin elections, but of course the search warrant that was executed at Mar-a-Lago. Somebody's got a classic picture of Peter Falk as Columbo posted with the caption, just one more thing, Mr. Trump. You wouldn't happen to have an evidence safe at Mar-a-Lago, would you? Which is exactly what you would expect from Columbo. And then there's California Congressman Eric Swalwell, who notes correctly, Donald Trump has a copy of the search warrant. He would show us the warrant if he were so wronged. So, you know, again, he's not obligated to show us what's in the search warrant, but much like his taxes, he can. He chooses not to. And that's, you know, that's where the ex-president finds himself today. It's going to be, unfortunately, it's probably going to take way too long for all of this to, you know, play itself out, find out what they were looking for in the safe. Does it lead to charges and things like that? So don't expect that this is going to be like an ongoing thing, much like a lot of things in the news business. We move on to the next shiny object pretty quickly. You know, once it becomes clear that there's not much else, you know, new to tell on this particular story yet, you know, look at the gap that there was before the January 6th committee, you know, came and started doing its thing. Patience would be the order of the day here. We covered over at Up North News some nice stories. Christina Laurie has been working on these. One of them was passing along rankings of some of the top Wisconsin cities and communities to live in. Livability.com uses all kinds of metrics to outline their top 100 best places to live. And six of those best American cities were or are in Wisconsin. So they were given or they were judged on eight different categories. There was civics, demographics, economy, education, health, housing, infrastructure, and amenities. And they looked at 2,300 cities that all had 500,000 people or less, you know, of which there's, you know, everything but Milwaukee here, but, you know, again, at least our communities are not being stacked up against, you know, a Chicago or a San Francisco or something like that. And for the second year in a row, Madison ranked number one nationally on the complete and total list of best places to live. You know, they note all the cultural attractions, the outdoor concerts, the, you know, the biking trails, the farmers market. It's a very welcoming place. And you know, this is the case by the growth that is happening here. And people have said, you know, certainly when I was, I lived in Madison briefly in 2017 before we, you know, relocated here to Chippewa Falls. And you could certainly see the growth, and you wonder, well, are they all coming from other major cities? And, you know, the honest and somewhat unfortunate answer is no. It's because, you know, there aren't as many jobs in Clark County or in Shawano County or wherever. And so, you know, Madison is where the jobs are. So it's a good place to be, but it is also a reminder that there's work we can do in other communities to help, you know, attract more people. We're actually going to talk about that later in this hour about the community of Boulder Junction. Waukesha was number 12 on the list. Appleton, number 39. Not a big surprise there. Green Bay ranked 74. That even with its winters on the frozen tundra, there's a lot to be said about the city's affordability and accessibility. Eau Claire, right down the road here, number 78. And La Crosse, 89. And I would argue Eau Claire and La Crosse should actually both be higher on that list because they are just downright gorgeous places to live and family friendly. And it just makes Wisconsin a fantastic place to be. But Boulder Junction could be too. And we'll talk more about that and how they're getting to be that way in just a minute. You're up north. Welcome back. This is Up North News. I'm Pat Kreitlow. I've discovered, Luke, one of the occupational hazards of this new show is that, you know, when you have breakfast at 5 a.m., as I do, and then you're on from 8 to 11, by 10 o'clock, I can't not think about lunch. And we've already talked about, you know, deep dish pizza. We've talked about cheese curds. We talked about, you know, the Schwann's trucks. Actually, you know what? We didn't talk about that on air. We were talking with our guest, Professor Michael Wagner, who's originally from Southwest Minnesota, the home of Schwann's and the ubiquitous Schwann's trucks that used to be everywhere and aren't as much to a degree. Although you're saying down there in Sunny Pea, you'll still see Schwann's trucks.
Yeah, a couple times a week. They come through the neighborhood. It's been a little bit less. The subdivision's getting redone with the roads right now. So a little less lately, but definitely throughout the few months that we've been living in Sun Prairie, I see with fair regularity the Schwann's truck driving around.
But I wonder if I'm not seeing it much anymore, if that really is a Schwann's truck or if that's, you know, kind of a Cheech and Chong, you know, ice cream truck situation that's going
I'll
on.
I'll have
there.
To get a closer look then because.
Why don't you do some research on that?
I'll go find out. I love the little cheese filled pretzel bites that they had. So if I do my research and I find out accordingly, you'll hear that I found some of the cheese filled pretzels then.
My thing, our thing from Schwann's, which was very surprising, but our favorite thing there was actually the pot roast. It was frozen, you know, it frozen and vacuum bagged, but you know, between the roast and the gravy that came with it, you put that frozen lump in your crock pot. And you know, when you come home from work, oh man, that was some good stuff. I do kind of miss that because we have not seen Schwann's trucks around Lake Wissota here in, I'd have to say, 8 years. So here I am thinking about lunch, you know, and it's not going to be,
I'm not thinking about lunch yet, but it's the cheese curds are definitely in my brain. And I don't know if I can wait until the local farmer's market tomorrow to go find some. So I might have to go on a little scouting excursion after we wrap up today's show.
Well, I kind of wonder, though. I mean, you get the fresh ones at the farmer's market on Saturdays. But, you know, by and large, when you're getting them at, you know, grocery stores, convenience stores, and things like that, they're not necessarily still squeaky fresh. And so then the question becomes, do you then get them if you don't know that they're, you know, a day old or less?
Yeah, that's true. The grocery store is almost, you're taking a risk. But the beautiful thing, like you just said, with Madison being number one in livability's rankings, it's because there's a ton of farmers markets. Not just the Dane County's farmers market on Saturdays is what Capital Square is known for. But there are local neighborhood farmers markets pretty much every single day out of the week across town. So you can find fresh, squeaky cheese curds almost at any day of the week in Madison, if you know where to go look.
I've mentioned that Christina Laurie, our reporter at Up North News, had worked for Channel 3 in Madison, and she loves the Dane County Farmers Market and has done a lot of stories about them, and that there are a lot of stories to be told about the various merchants, because they're not all, you know, Madison-based or even Dane County-based. Some folks drive hours in basically the middle of the night to come set up at that farmer's market and others. And it's one of those things that I've given her the green light to do more stories about, you know, some of these rural farm entrepreneurs who are basically making their own market, going to farmers markets in Eau Claire and La Crosse and Madison and elsewhere. So I hope we get to talk more about that. But the story that I want to share right now that you're actually hearing about first. We have not yet posted it at upnorthnewswi.com. It has not yet been in our newsletter. It has not yet been on social media, but I finally finished the video version of the report 2 days ago and finished editing the print version last night. So it's finally going to get posted. The working headline is "How Little Boulder Junction Went Big on Bringing Broadband to Town." And this was a story that was reported on by freelance reporter Evan J. Pretzer up in the Wausau area. I asked him to go to Boulder Junction and find out what was happening there. We'd seen a few local stories about how they were trying to increase their internet speed, which meant upgrading their entire infrastructure. Keep in mind, Boulder Junction's population is about 956. There's not even 1,000 people there. And yet, the residents there of this, quiet little place up north were asked in a local survey by the Economic Development Committee, you know, what are the big issues in Boulder Junction? And by and large, it was about slow internet speed. Basically the internet went about as fast as the glaciers that carved out that area so long ago. The ones that Tom Tiffany, you know, thanks God for global warming on when they retreated. We talked to the library director up there, Sherry Sanderson, who would share how families would be screaming at each other to get off the internet. You know, how many browser tabs do you have open? What are you downloading? Dina Casso is the executive director of the local Chamber of Commerce, and she said there was a predictable daily contraction of internet bandwidth at about 5 o'clock. She said everybody would be checking their phones and that, you know, they could not get things done in the office, because it was either you know, adults or kids doing homework. And so basically they were finding out that, you know, DSL or digital subscriber line speeds weren't enough. They weren't getting it done. And Boulder Junction had a DSL infrastructure in part thanks to federal funding that tried to grow, you know, internet outreach into rural parts of America over the years, but that was just no longer enough. I mean, we're downloading movies and games and all kinds of things now, not just, you know, things one page at a time. And so you had a case where in Wisconsin, well, let me put it this way, in the nation, 4.5% of Americans don't have access to even one fixed broadband service. 4.4% in the United States. In Wisconsin, that number was 6.8%. So we're above average in the people lacking one good broadband connection. So city leaders, community and civic leaders decided they were tired of that and started to do their homework to find out, you know, how much would it cost to upgrade to broadband speeds? How much could they afford? Hint, not much. It's a small town. But what other forms of support were out there? And now keep in mind, this is pre-COVID when they're looking into this and discovering that, again, politicians in many ways bipartisan, but not always, were increasing the pots of money that were available to help expand high-speed internet. Because more people, politicians and others, were realizing that high-speed internet today is what interstate highways used to be, what railroads used to be back in the day. If you did not have these things, your community was not going to grow. And so a lot of communities would complain about slow internet speeds, but local officials in Boulder Junction got to work. They worked out a plan. They said the key to their plan was frequent transparency, frequent updates to the public in electors' meetings and in other ways, so that when there was finally an electors' vote on whether to move forward, the vote was overwhelmingly in favor of moving forward. So the project has cost about $8 million so far. About $3 million of that has come in from the community, which voted to, you know, have its own taxes raised for this. But then another nearly $4 million has come from the administration of Governor Tony Evers. And then a private partner, CenturyLink, has given about $1 million as well. And then, of course, you had the federal funding. So this is all to say that, you know, a lot of people love to talk about how, you know, government doesn't work. You know, government can't work. You talk to the people there, like Dennis Hochstick of the Economic Development and Broadband Committee, and he said, don't say that up here. Government works. Government worked up here in bringing the people together and then in coupling that with other levels of government that, you know, kicked in as well, because no small town can do a big project like this on its own. And this is, frankly, you know, the key to growing the rural economy in Wisconsin and across the country. So the Evers administration has already given out more than $225 million statewide for expansion grants. President Biden put in a request for $100 billion nationwide for broadband expansion as part of the bipartisan infrastructure law. Congressional Republicans wouldn't go that far. So in order to get their votes, Biden had to cut that number down to $65 billion. It's still a good chunk of change, but again, not as ambitious as he would have liked. And of that $65 billion in the bipartisan infrastructure law, about $100 million more is going to come to Wisconsin in order to grow high-speed coverage around the state. But again, this doesn't happen automatically. Just because a pot of money is made available doesn't mean it's coming to you. Good things come to those who do the homework. And in Boulder Junction, they did the homework. Then COVID hit, and they came to appreciate even more what a good decision that they made, for reasons like, of course, education, as kids had to stay home, telemedicine, and of course, working from home, which only exploded. So according to the story that Evan Pretzer put together for us that we're posting later today, about half the community will have broadband this summer, and the rest should be completely wired by the end of this year. Now, that's not every place, because again, there's a lot of land that has to be trenched, you know, to lay these lines. Not everybody wants that, but the vast majority of the town is going to be wired now for high-speed broadband internet because they did their work. 38 miles of line is being laid to serve about 1,200 units. So from a business standpoint, again, Dina Casso from the Chamber of Commerce said that it has certainly helped from a business standpoint. It has made it easier to market and promote the town, whether that's business owners, young families moving in, remote workers, and also Sherry Sanderson, the library director, noted an increase in people coming up and starting to work out of their vacation home or their parents' home, because more people can be flexible on where they are when they do their work. I mean, I'm sitting here in a home office on Lake Wissota, you know, rather than in a radio studio someplace, because we can do that thanks to broadband. And so as Bill Nemeth of the Broadband Committee in Boulder Junction said in wrapping things up, there are very few truly bipartisan issues today, and that's unfortunate, but broadband is one of them. And it seems, he says, that so many electors and constituents are on board, elected officials see that, and then they get on board. And so the funding needs to keep coming in, because he says these projects in rural America, in rural Wisconsin, will not get done unless there's public funding. So we thought that it was a great example of how government works. There's a lot to be said about government accountability, about when things go wrong, when politicians don't keep their promises. We certainly covered the horse race of the bipartisan infrastructure law and the, you know, the give and take of the American Rescue Plan and now the Inflation Reduction Act. But in the end, when these policies are finally done and implemented, again, it takes a while to see it. But as you can see in Little Boulder Junction, some big things are now happening with improved speed, where they're actually showing an increase in people moving to town and having to make sure they have enough affordable housing stock for it. This is Up North News. I'm Pat Kreitler. We'll take a break. More after this.
You're listening to Up North News with Pat Kreitler.
It was so weird to have Sandy, the good girl from Greece, end up being the same person doing physical with a song that ended, "Let's Get Animal." But we were all good with that. So rest in peace, Olivia Newton-John. It is Tuesday morning. This is Up North News. I'm Pat Kreitler, and I'm getting a haircut, as people found out over the commercial break. I was telling Luke, I've been going to the same guy, Dan, or as I call him, Dan the Barber Man, for 26 years now. When he was just a youngin' fresh out of barber school, he wasn't, you know, he didn't have, now since then he was dating, then a wife and kids. The kids are graduated. He's talking about, you know, we're talking about retirement plans now. And Luke asked how I was getting my hair cut for those 3 years when I lived on Grand Cayman in the Caribbean. And my answer was expensively. One of the things we take for granted here in Wisconsin is you can still get, you know, you still get your hair cut for a pretty affordable price compared to where'd you say you were? DC with the prices there.
Yeah. Washington, DC. That was the, I think the most money I've ever spent on a haircut was the summer I was living there. And it looked really great, but I was like, wait, you're charging
how much? Do you recall roughly what it was?
I want to say I paid close to, because after tip, I was still tipped. I want to say it was close to like $55-$60.
Yeah. Now this, of course, was, you know, 8-9 years ago in Grand Cayman. So I'm sure the prices have changed. $65 to get a haircut. You know, and but I will say, with no offense to Dan the Barber Man, you know, in Eau Claire, but she was worth every penny. Fantastic haircuts. My wife also found a salon there that, again, charged more money than you thought humanly possible. But, you know, again, a lot of talent. It takes a lot of talent to be able to, you know, charge those kind of prices to live on a small island in the Caribbean.
Well, one thing I did not know as well is the discrepancy between a male haircut and a female haircut for the longest time. And that is just crazy to me, because if I really wanted to, I could look through like a newspaper and get a clippings over at Great Clips for like, I don't know, there's got to be a coupon in there for a $7.99, $8.99 haircut.
And yeah, and it might look like it.
Yeah, you get what you
pay for. But you can get it. That's the whole point. You can get a cheap haircut.
Right,
you
know? But just to have like a touch-up for a female haircut is like $25, which is pretty more typical of what I spend now. But it's crazy to think that there's such a big difference between those.
Oh, yeah, without a doubt. It is these kinds of very weighty and serious policy matters that we think the Wisconsin legislature and Congress ought to be working on?
We're waiting on some primary results, and the Wisconsin legislature is taking a 10-month vacation. So what else do you want us to talk about on a Tuesday morning?
Well, that's just it. So what are legislators doing? Well, some of them are being primaried. Assembly Speaker Robin Voss tops on that list, because even though he has, through appointing Michael Gableman, done so much to continue the big lie and the damage that Donald Trump is doing to American democracy, that's still not good enough for Trump's fans. And they're primarying him because he refuses to try to decertify the election, which is not a thing. Doesn't exist. Not legal. Can't happen. Wasn't any fraud anyway. Stop it. But they won't stop it. So last night, backers of Voss's primary opponent, Adam Steen, held an event called Toss Voss. And what it was a giant bungee slingshot that was put up on a flatbed trailer behind a pickup truck, and they put Robin Voss's face on several dummies, and what people could, I don't know if they paid or signed up or what they did, but this giant slingshot would then fling the Robin Voss dummy into a field. It's not the same as burning somebody in effigy, I guess, but it's no less ridiculous.
They were going for the rhyme, though. They wanted the Toss Voss event.
Yes, so
they were tossing him.
Good for them. And already they've gotten far more mileage out of this than they deserve, because I saw a report this morning that about 25 people showed up, and goodness knows how many of them were reporters. And so by attendance, it was a dismal failure. But of course, you know that thousands upon thousands of people, you know, heard about it through news reports and, you know, radio shows like this. And so consequently, you've got a Speaker of the Assembly who might, you know, we've certainly seen that before, surprising results in primaries where incumbents are unseated. Again, I'm not saying it's going to happen, but I'm not saying it's impossible.
Eric Cantor, one of the most conservative members of the House of Representatives, got primaried from the right, and that's how he lost his seat. So there's precedent for it. It could happen.
And there was a Democratic speaker, a majority leader, I think, from Washington State that got bounced that way in the 90s, early 2000s as well, if I'm not mistaken. So much of these primaries and midterms hinge on what has been accomplished or not accomplished. And it is really striking what a turnaround there has been in just the past couple of weeks, when it looked like Democrats were toast and that, you know, Republicans were not only going to, you know, make some gains, but maybe it would turn into a rout come November, because the messaging had been, you know, that so little was getting done, even though, again, the clock hadn't run down to zero yet. There were still things to be done. And so now we're getting to conditions in this country coming into the midterms where by the end of Biden's first 2 years in office, you have the following conditions: 10 million new jobs. We've made back all the jobs lost from COVID and then grown them from there. 10 million new jobs. Unemployment, 3.6%. That's a 50-year low. An 86% drop in the death rate from COVID. The biggest ever infrastructure bill has been passed. The first gun safety bill in 30 years has been passed. Medicare bulk purchasing passed as part of the Inflation Reduction Act. Electoral college reform has been passed. A bill that would codify gay marriage has passed the House. A restart of the U.S. microchip industry passed and was signed into law earlier this morning by President Biden. You had from people that say, you know, will Black voters show up the way that they did 2 years ago? Well, the list for them includes appointing more Black women to the courts than anyone, including the U.S. Supreme Court. Lynching has finally been made a federal hate crime after 200 attempts. Minority-owned business spending, federal spending, increased by $100 billion over 5 years. Sorry, I'm going to cough here. A huge drop in Black unemployment, as you would expect. $10 billion in minority lending, funding for historically Black colleges and universities, a ban on chokeholds and no-knock warrants for federal law enforcement, and a doubling of the Department of Justice Civil Rights Division staff. And yet, despite all of that, when we listed some of those at Up North News over the weekend, one of the comments was about inflation. And I loved it because the comment was, well, a bag of Lay's potato chips in the grocery store is now costing $5. $5 for a bag of Lay's. So I looked into that. You can get Lay's at Target for $3.99. Potato chips have not hit $5. More importantly, it's not just that. Why are you worried about the price of a bag of potato chips when the price of insulin could have been capped at $35? And instead, you know, we're still being gouged because you have people in Congress on the Republican side voting against insulin price caps, voting against baby formula relief, voting against funding for COVID testing, voting against paid leave for families, voting against more consistent election standards nationwide to guard against actual fraud, should it ever happen, voting against extending the expanded child tax credit. All of these things and more have a reporter for the New York Times asking in a column on Sunday, why is Ron Johnson still competitive despite, you know, everything? That's the actual headline. So I wanted to look more at this. Michelle Cottle is the author, a member of the New York Times editorial board, and doing my part to help destroy American journalism by reading things that are normally behind a paywall. I will share some of what she wrote. Sorry, Luke, were you about to defend paywalls?
No, I find that very funny, and I appreciate the little snark towards the paywall.
Well, look, I believe everybody should be a subscriber to things that they read. You know, I pay to subscribe to the Milwaukee Journal, you know, the New York Times, the Washington Post, a host of news sites around Wisconsin. But I will still tell you, we did this completely wrong. In the earliest days of the interwebs, when Steve Jobs came up with 99 cents per song, I was one of those, along with others, who said, this is what the news media needs to do as well, is people don't want to pay like $50 for a subscription, but if they want to read this particular article, you know, if you charge them, you know, a dime or something. And what we were told at the time was, well, that level of micro purchasing, like 10 cents to read an article, and then, you know, it accrues over time. And then at the end of the month, maybe $8.75 is deducted from your credit card or whatever the case may be. And we were told, you know, that wasn't a good business model. You know, it wouldn't pay for itself. And yet Apple made it work 99 cents at a time. And I still think that is what not just the news media, but other sites could have done to not have these paywalls that are downright onerous to folks. But anyway, now that we're back here behind the paywall, let's read on. From Michelle Cottle in the New York Times. Of all the political quandaries and questions of the 2022 midterms, one burns especially bright. How is it that Ron Johnson, the two-term Republican from Wisconsin, remains even a remotely viable candidate for re-election? The Trump era has given us so many, let's say, colorful characters. But Mr. Johnson may be the senator who most fully embodies the detached from reality elements of MAGA world, the guy most likely to spend his spare time fashioning tinfoil hats while cruising QAnon message boards. His irrational and irresponsible conspiracy mongering about matters such as the COVID vaccine, the 2020 election, who was really behind the January 6th riots, unsettles even some of his Republican colleagues. Mr. Johnson has gotten so out there that his brand is suffering with the voters back home. His favorability numbers have been largely underwater for the past couple of years. He is considered perhaps the most vulnerable Republican incumbent on the midterm ballot, a tempting target for Democrats looking to keep control of the Senate. But Mr. Johnson is not easy pickings, and the reasons are revealing about today's political climate, especially how voters in a battleground state with serious economic issues and other concerns like a pre-Civil War abortion ban still on the books may yet again wind up hitched to a guy who spends an awful lot of time on embarrassing distractions. And that I'll end my reading right there for a bit, because it's not just those things. It's the very real positions that he has taken. Like, for example, not fighting for jobs for Oshkosh Defense to build the next generation of postal vehicles in his own hometown, you know, by saying, well, it's not like there aren't enough jobs already in Wisconsin. It is that kind of disconnect that, yes, has plenty of people wondering. But what we can't forget is that elections are not decided purely on the issues and whether things are good or bad. Ron Johnson, this time around, is the beneficiary, of a lot of money from billionaires that he helped slash their taxes in the 2017 tax bill. Prior to that, while this was not something that Johnson was necessarily culpable of, The NRA was accused of funneling Russian money into American politics. And Ron Johnson was one of those Senate campaigns that benefited from it, you know, the last time around, you know, back when Johnson promised that he was only going to run for a second term and not a third. Still, Russ Feingold managed to lose two times here in Wisconsin for reasons of his own making, as well as some of these external factors. And so while the national media is saying Ron Johnson is a liability, in the very next breath, they're saying Mandela Barnes might be too liberal for Wisconsin, even though Wisconsin is a lean progressive state from a statewide perspective, if you don't look at gerrymandered legislative maps. That's why this race is going to be so close, why it's going to be a toss-up, and why we have to pay attention to the media narratives and straighten them out when they go astray from time to time. We'll wrap up today's show right after this. You're up north. Imagine Tim Michaels and Rebecca Clefish doing this as a duo, talking about their summer nights of campaigning, and it all culminates, sorry Luke, it all culminates today in a primary.
Did you know that they both have the same birthday, and it was Sunday.
That's right. Even though the same birthday. This is a couple that should have been running, you know, maybe as a ticket or something, and instead we get to talk about them one final time running against each other, and one of them will come out of today's voting as the nominee for governor to take on Tony Evers. But it remains to be seen because neither one is a clear favorite. So I'm looking at Scott Bauer's story in the Associated Press that kind of, you know, ties a bow on this whole primary campaign between them. And you can't help but note that, you know, Tim Michaels has dumped $12 million of his own money into the race, which is not a surprise. I mean, this is how Ron Johnson got into the race initially, was Republicans like to lean on who's the rich guy who can somehow appear as an outsider. And that's what Donald Trump did. And now it's what Tim Michaels is doing, trying to be a Donald Trump, you know, type of outsider, when the fact of the matter is Tim Michaels is no outsider. He was the Republican nominee for U.S. Senate and, you know, lost to Russ Feingold in 2004. And he's been involved in other political endeavors. He's been involved in state associations that had to take positions on things like a gas tax and immigrant labor. So this is not somebody that just, you know, showed up out of Connecticut or New York or Wisconsin. He has Trump's backing. Clefish has, you know, a former Vice President Mike Pence's backing. Michaels has, of course, played along with the whole charade that there was something wrong with the 2020 elections. Rebecca Clefish kind of had to be pulled into that. Initially, she had said, you know, Joe Biden is the winner of the election. Now she's saying, you know, that the election was rigged, even though she knows that it wasn't. So either one of them already will come into the general election as damaged goods, simply by buying into the big lie. And I understand that many Republicans last week in other states lost because they did not buy into the big lie. So what? That's a badge of honor that they get to carry. Whereas the people embracing Donald Trump, that will eventually turn and they will have to carry that shame for the rest of their natural lives, you know, at some point down the road. So you've got them both claiming, you know, the big lie. You've got Clefish, who going again by the AP story, is described as a former Milwaukee television news anchor. Oh, they're the worst news anchors that go into politics. A teenage beauty pageant contestant who got into politics as part of a five-way primary for lieutenant governor in 2010. She was not Scott Walker's choice. Now, in Wisconsin, you don't run as a team like you do with president and vice president. The lieutenant governor's race is wide open. You get who you get. You know, Tony Evers and Mandela Barnes didn't run as a ticket until after the primary. Scott Walker, you know, was not looking to run with Rebecca Clefish, but then she came through the primary, and now Walker, you know, is backing his former lieutenant governor. Michaels, of course, has spent about, like it says, about $1 million a week. He has stumbled at times. He flip-flopped on whether he would back Trump for a run in 2024. at one of the most recent debates. He didn't appear to know what DACA was, the highly contentious immigration program, even as he has been ripping on undocumented immigrants. And let me just say, and we'll play the ad if he wins the race today. I'm sure we'll play this ad a lot, because he was running an early ad that ends with the line, "It's not racist to enforce the law," you know, after he's been denigrating Mexicans and Central Americans who are trying to escape violence and oppression. Quick hint here, whether you're an uncle at a family dinner or a candidate for governor, if you've got to say it's not racist, but you know what it sounds like. And at this point, you're doing that on purpose. And we see that in Tim Michaels. You see it in the ads where he's all, you know, driving his pickup truck and he's unshaven. And I mean really unshaven, like railroad hobo unshaven, to try to appear like the common man and not somebody living in, you know, mega-million-dollar condos and mansions and things like that. So coming out of this, if it's Michaels, expect this very strong anti-immigrant position. And if it's Clefish, expect this very strong crime thing that she was doing with Mike Pence last week. In both cases, these are campaigns that are run and will continue to be run after today on villainizing people, either those scary people from down south or those scary people from Milwaukee and Racine and Kenosha and Chicago. And of course, vilifying Governor Tony Evers, who, much like Joe Biden, has not had a bad couple of years and has a record to run on. And Republicans, meanwhile, will have to defend the things that they were against. But as I've noted, and as I noted in our Up North News newsletter editorial yesterday, you have to stand for something. And what is it that you stand for? You may not like the sausage making of government. And the horse race media remains addicted to instant gratification. But some people do the actual work of shepherding legislation through the minefield of Congress or the legislature and getting things done. So it's fair to ask Republicans who have tried to block every step of Biden's or Evers' progress and say, what do you stand for? What will you do that could improve the lives of Americans and Wisconsinites? Because Evers, Biden, and others have been doing the work. But what work are you willing to do to actually improve things? If you give a milquetoast response like, well, I'm for freedom or limited government or, you know, free enterprise. No, those aren't answers. Again, that's milquetoast. That's pablum. Those are concepts. And they say nothing about what you would actually do, when it appears what you would do is make it harder to have free and fair elections, make it harder for people to vote, make it harder for consumers and workers to not be treated like crap. So when you give answers like that, it tells me you're not willing to do the kind of work, make the tough decisions, seek the compromises that would create actual new legislation that would address the challenges that Americans are facing every day. It takes work to make the tax system more fair, to make healthcare more affordable, to provide help to sick veterans who've been exposed to burn pits and other conditions. It takes work to incentivize job creation. You can't just write $4 billion on a cocktail napkin, give it to Foxconn, and hope for the best. We saw how well that worked out with Rebecca Clefish and Scott Walker last time around. It takes work to add layers of gun safety protection or to attack a global climate crisis. Work is what gets done when you stand for something more than slogans, conspiracy theories, and funny red hats. So for that and more, you can watch, read our newsletter, sign up for it at upnorthnewswi.com, or join us again here tomorrow morning when we talk about primary election winners and losers and how things look in November. I'm Pat Kreitlow. Have a great day.